Indian Catholic organization has called on members to starve themselves to death in protest before the release of the Da Vinci Code movie. I think this is a marvelous idea and that Muslims should take notice and emulate these heroic Christians. An organization official said, "It's a more Christian way of doing things rather than pulling down things and tearing them up." Well, the Christian way has tended to be to slaughter people as Jesus allegedly dictated, but I guess it's been a couple centuries since that happened on any significant scale. So I guess he's right. Yes, any Christian so offended by a work of fictional entertainment that they lack the will to live, do the Christian thing and starve yourselves to fucking death. And that was from the Project for the New Anarchist Century. And this is the Hellbound Alley program. I'm Allie. With me is Francois.
Charlie. Yes.
And we also have our good friend, Andrew Grieve, with us. Hello, Andrew.
Good afternoon, guys.
Well, good. I don't know if he's a good friend, per se.
And also,
he's a friend.
Our other good friend and our guest today is Stefan Molyneux. Hello, Stefan.
Hello. How's it going, guys?
Good. Okay, so
we're in fine form.
So that's great. Thanks for that article there.
Yeah, starve yourself to death. You know, that's so true. You know, every time I see something in the media, like a new Christian show, I always think, maybe I should starve myself to death.
Well,
you know
I tend to just recommend that people pray about it.
Prayer good too. It doesn't do shit, but you don't die. So
well, starving yourself to death seems more constructive, but I think it's about as constructive, and this is something interesting, as what people do who have obsessive compulsive disorder. And I read an article once by a Hasidic Jew, or an ex-Hasidic Jew, who said that the rituals of the Hasidic culture had a lot in common with obsessive compulsive disorder. Like people who walk around and have to count the number of steps, or stick their tongue to light switches, or beat their head on the desk three times, or, you know, whatever they do. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that this kind of thing, you know, these kinds of rituals are, with obsessive-compulsive disorder, according to the article, people do it because it makes them feel like they're in control. But actually, of course, the rituals are in control of them. It's kind of obvious.
Right.
But in a way, these religious rituals are people controlling the universe, but the universe is controlling them. But it, with praying and with starving yourself to death, I think it sort of has the same flavor.
There is an interesting theory, and I don't know who came up with it, but it's a theory about one of the reasons that people start believing in religious silliness is if you sort of imagine like you're a tribe and you live at the foot of a volcano, and that volcano is going to erupt from time to time, the question is, how do you manage the stress of not knowing when that's going to happen? Well, the way that you do it is you imagine that the volcano is inhabited by an angry fire god, and if you perform certain rituals, you can manage the stress of not knowing when danger is going to occur. Because you say, well, I did these rituals, and so on, and then if it happens despite the rituals, you just change the rituals, which is similar to OCD as well. So I think that it's just a way of managing the stress of not knowing when certain dangers are going to happen in life, and that's part of what this repetitive kind of compulsion helps
people
to do.
You change the rituals, and then the Babylonians capture you, and you call it covenant theology.
It's the same thing as civilizations who live near water, rivers, and lakes. You know, floods.
But when I was talk a lot about the power of prayer. There's a lot of, you know, mumbling about the power of prayer. And it's the same thing, but
yeah, exactly. It's a ritual designed to make you believe that you're doing something.
But it's not
actually going out and helping people.
It's not very scriptural. I mean, at sure least with starving yourself, there's an element of making people feel guilty. With prayer, there's not as much guilt associated when you tell people you're praying for them.
It is scriptural, because Jesus said, if two people pray for something, you'll get it.
Well, it seems a bit contradictory. I'm just saying, because God doesn't want you to think that you can influence him. Otherwise, why did Job go through all of that? Anyway, we're starting to get into a really big scriptural discussion.
Debate. It's scripture debate.
Just before we move on, I have a funny story about Hasidic Jews that when I was younger, I lived in Montreal for a couple of years, and I went to the National Theater School. And I lived in a neighborhood not too far from the Hasidic Jew neighborhood, and I was walking to go to a rehearsal one Saturday morning. And a gentleman with the sort of corkscrew sideburns and the funny hat and so on stopped me on the street and said, could I ask you for a favor? And I said, sure, no problem. And so he asked me to come upstairs and to turn on the heating. Right? He said, well, no, I didn't realize it was going to be so cold today, because it's Montreal, right? So maybe he didn't know. And he asked me to come up, and he said, could you turn the heating on, please, for me? And he was just pointing me at a switch, right, just sitting there on the wall, and I guess I turned the switch on, but I didn't know enough about comparative religion to know what the purpose of it was, but of course, they can't use any, they can't do any work on Saturday, right? So I just thought that was kind of funny, because, you know, in hindsight, it's like, okay, so it's immoral to not do any work on Saturday, but let's get this guy to do it and take on the sin for me. I just thought that was kind of funny.
And to walk all the way over and find a guy is not working and flipping.
But then, and he explained to me that he couldn't do the work, and then he said, but can I offer you a cup of coffee? And I thought, well, if it was brewed last night, no, actually not really. Maybe he set a timer, I don't know, right?
Unless you have a servant who's, you know, Quebecois or something. And
that's
right.
That is so bizarre.
You know, there's a guy you can ask if you need to get to temple or something on roller skates. Is it okay to skate there?
Right.
If you need to get there fast, you can find online all kinds of answers.
There's a very funny Woody Allen film, because it's not one of his more recent ones, where it's called Radio Days, and he lives next door to some communists, right? And the communists are having a great time on Saturday, and Woody Allen, as a Jew, isn't allowed to do anything on Saturday. He's just going to sit around and stare at his family members. And he says, you know, it makes me so angry. I'd burn down their house, but I'm not allowed to light a match. <That's pretty funny. sighs>
Okay. Now.
All right, enough fun. Let's.
No more fun. Let's
no more fun.
Down to brass tacks, whatever that means.
Well, yeah, what does that mean?
Getting down to brass tacks.
What does, I don't get it. What does it mean?
You know, I'm going to write that down and find out.
We have to find out. Maybe.
The essential elements, it seems, but when you say get down to brass tacks, doesn't it, did I just use, like, the wrong metaphor?
No,
that's right,
sure?
That's right.
I mean, it's just every time Ali or I see an expression, we always think, where does that come from?
I can I just learned about one the other day. You know that phrase, he's going the whole nine yards?
Okay, yeah, well, what is that about?
The whole nine yards comes from World War II, in that the Spitfire airplane that the Royal Air Force used could hold 9 yards worth of bullets in its wings. So when somebody came back and had shot everything that they'd been loaded up with and shot all their bullets, they'd shot the whole 9 yards, they'd gone the whole distance, so that's where that phrase comes from.
Well, I knew it couldn't be football.
No, because the whole 9 yards wouldn't be much at all then.
Yeah, it should at least be 10 yards to make a first down. But 9, I don't know.
Well, I'll look up brass tacks later.
So today is our Introduction to Market Anarchy with Stefan and Andrew. And this is not our first introduction. The fans of the show, you know who you are, all three of you, have know about our Intro to Atheism, show number 2, Intro to Strong Atheism, show number 38, and Introduction to Libertarianism, show 60. So it has been a while since we've done one. But
those are generally pretty popular shows.
Yes.
So anarchism, you're talking about throwing Molotov cocktails, right?
And I would like, by the way, to apologize for any prostatus comment that I might have made on show 60. No, I will now reverse them all, because since then we've become orchid anarchists.
Everyone out there listening, please remember this date, the May 12th, 2006, the date that Francois Tremblay, or is it the 13th, the day that Francois Tremblay apologized. Just...
Really, really, what is that Monty Python sketch? I'm really, really sorry. I really apologize. Remember that?
I'm sorry, I don't.
Okay, never mind.
But I'm sure that we have enough nerds out there that know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay. So, yeah, I'm sure people think anarchy is really terrible and...
It's
chaos.
What they did in my hometown back during the world, you know, the G8 thing when all the Seattleites went out on the street and, broke windows of Starbucks coffee. That meant, and they, it was all blamed on, quote, the anarchists.
But I would like to assure you that indeed in my months of being an anarchist, I have yet to throw a bomb or set something on fire, although I do have the desire to do so sometimes.
That's for the NSA to sort out, right?
Yeah, exactly. But no, because I'm not American. But it doesn't matter, I guess.
Nobody cares about
the Americans.
Canadians
don't really care about borders anyway. But but no, we're going to start from the ground up today. We're going to go through the whole nine yards. We're going to run the whole nine yards or shoot the whole nine yards.
Shoot.
And we're going to...
we're going to
start by looking at a certain... we're going to start by looking at the arguments. We're going to start by looking at the worldview that market anarchy is based on. And we're going to start with the Stefan. I think Stefan has had a lot to do with this argument, the moral argument. And Stefan, I understand that you wanted to start this by reading an email that you got recently.
Yeah, actually, I thought it would be worthwhile just to give people a sense of the difficulties that other people are having with the argument for morality. So this is difficulties that people are having in deconverting it. So I'll just read you this this email, and then we can take that as a launching point. So this is from a lady named Cynthia, and she says, "Hi, Steph. I don't know how you stand it. My husband and I are enjoying your podcast, and I thought I'd try my hand at the argument for morality in a Yahoo group for atheist homeschoolers. Every time it's my turn to respond, I experience this wave of frustration, like, where on earth do I begin? This all started when someone on the list asked about the connection between atheism and libertarianism. She said she liked libertarianism in some ways, but wasn't, quote, a big fan of guns, and, quote, liked the social safety net. After responding as briefly and simply as I could, she went on and on about the welfare state being imperfect but virtuous, lots of anecdotes, and then how she hated guns so much. Here's where we're at so far. My last message. I appreciate your sentiments and think we have a great many attitudes in common. But let me ask you this. If I decide not to pay money into this particular safety net, do you or do you not support the use of force against me? Let's be very clear here. It starts with a fine from the IRS, but if I continue to resist it, eventually it comes to a gunpoint. Do you hate guns enough to say that it is wrong for the IRS to point them at me? And ask not what your country can force others to do to you." Her response, so this is the response of the woman on the site. She says, "I would hope that the IRS would turn to wage garnishments, property liens, or asset freezes first. And to answer your question honestly, if someone flouts the law to the point that police activity is required, then that someone has to expect that guns are going to be pointed at him or her. But I don't agree with your assumption that someone has the right to decide whether to pay into the social safety net or not. I'm thoroughly unhappy with the use of a very, very large portion of my tax dollars, but as a resident of the U.S., enjoying the protections and privileges thereof, I still have a responsibility to pay taxes. If only I could withhold that portion of my taxes corresponding to the support of programs I dislike. With two self-employed people in her family, we take a nasty big tax hike every year. Let me clarify what I mean by hating guns. I find them personally revolting. I would not feel comfortable so much as eating dinner in a room with a gun rack on the wall. They give me the heebie-jeebies, but the right to own them is enshrined in our Constitution. And I'm not a pick-and-choose Bill of Rights kind of girl. Just because I hate them and they make me feel sick doesn't mean that hunters shouldn't be able to own them, police officers shouldn't carry them, or my recently acrimoniously divorced friend shouldn't be able to keep one in her husband, to keep one in her nightstand to fend off unwanted midnight visits from her evil ex, blah, blah, blah. So she doesn't really know what to do from there, and the last thing she says is, I guess my next move will be to ask her if there are bad laws that should not be obeyed, a la Hitler, and or ask her if she thinks stealing is ever wrong, even if it's for a good cause or something like that. What does she teach her children about taking something by force? She homeschools, which is amazing, since obedience training in public schools seems perfect for her. And she finishes off by saying, this is the first time in my libertarian life of 14 years that I've stuck to the argument for morality, as I learned from listening to you. It does simplify things, but I'm so disturbed by these conversations, I'm trying to decide if it's worth it. So that's how she ends up. So I think it's pretty clear that it's very difficult for people to use this argument for morality or to deconvert people from an ethics standpoint. But I think it's very important for us to try and give people some better tools or other ways of approaching it.
Absolutely. But from the email that you read, it seems to me that she didn't start that well because they were engaged on a pretty specific thing there.
Yes,
like
I agree.
Guns and social programs. It seems to me that she probably didn't start from argument for morality or the geometry argument.
That's true, and she also lets the, this is another important thing too, is she lets her opponent define the terms, right? So as soon as somebody starts talking about the social safety net, right? I mean, I wouldn't even allow somebody to define it in that kind of manner, right? Because if you're against the social safety net, then obviously you want, you know, poor people to die in the streets and sick people to die in the streets and so on. So I think it's always important to just not deal with specific government policies or anything
exactly.
like that. Just start approaching from it. It's okay, let's just sort of, if you're going to have an ethical theory, let's just start talking about what your ethical theory might look like, right? Let's not worry about government programs or this or that or the other. You're saying that if someone lives in a certain geographical region, then other people have the right to force them to do stuff, right? And then she's going to say, well, the voting and this and that. It's like, no, forget about the voting, right? Who gets to use a gun in your system of morality, right? That's sort of where you've got to start. And forget about George Bush or the Iraq War or Social Security or welfare, any of that kind of stuff, because that's all stuff that's just really confusing and is way downstream from an original ethical theory.
Yeah, and when you talked about the safety net, what I would say to that is, yeah, I'm all for that. But how do you get that with a state? What are the incentives of the state to provide such a net? What does the state do for the poor? And that's, if you look at the issue impartially, the answer has got to be nothing.
Well, I think the state does quite a bit for the poor in terms of making sure that there are lots of them to justify state intervention, right?
Exactly.
I think it does quite a bit to enhance their numbers. But
exactly.
I think it is... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing with you exactly. That's pretty much... every time a state tells you about something that is necessary, that seems to be always applicable. That, you know, the state has no incentive to provide it. The state does not provide it. And the only real way to have it is as a product in a market.
Yes, that's true. And I think another place that this person goes wrong, I mean, entirely understandably, right, because this is difficult stuff to get the hang of. But when this opponent, right, her opponent says, I don't agree with your assumption that someone has the right to decide whether to pay into a social safety net or not. Right, because she says, well, as a resident of the U.S. or whichever country, enjoying the protections and privileges thereof, I have a responsibility to pay my taxes. The idea that it's a social contract is something that is very, very common when it comes to deconverting people or helping them to understand that it's not a social contract if it's unilaterally imposed through the use of force. Like, so people say here up in Canada, right, that we have socialized medicine, and so you get all the benefits of that, and therefore you should pay into it, and so on. And it doesn't really logically make sense. I can't sort of say to someone, I'm going to deliver you a newspaper every week, and you have to pay me, whether you want it or not, or like it or not, or find it offensive or not. Because I'm delivering you the newspaper, you have to pay me.
Mm-hmm.
And so you also have to break through this kind of stuff, like there's some sort of contract involved, and because you get a benefit from the state, and I do too, right? My roads are subsidized and so on. And so because you get certain financial benefits from the state that you somehow owe them, those people money, is another challenge in terms of deconverting people to get them to understand if it's not voluntarily entered into to mutual benefit and signed on an individual basis. It's not a contract. It's not a social contract at all.
Here's where it becomes the mob coming to your business and saying, we're protecting you now, so if you don't pay us for our protection, we're going to burn down your business.
Exactly.
Right, and the other thing, too, is like I can't sort of go to Francois and say, listen, I've bought this car on your behalf, and I will let you get to use it on weekends, though I'll be using it during the week, but the whole bill's going to go to you. Is that, you know, I'm not even going to ask you if that's okay, I'm just going to send you the bill. Well, everybody would recognize that you can't enter into a contract for your own benefit on behalf of someone else. And so the fact that the bureaucrats pay themselves first, always, before, quote, helping the poor or helping the sick, and, you know, the amount of money that trickles down to help the sick and the poor from the state programs is so ludicrously small, right? I think up here in Canada, if you just took the number of poor people and divided it by the amount of money that goes into the poverty programs, all the poor people would get like $200,000 a year instead of like the $15,000 they get a year. So that differentiation is something that entirely benefits the bureaucrats and the politicians and the unions and has absolutely nothing to do with actually helping the poor. So even a self-interested contract can't be entered into and have somebody else pay in a private sector. It's just weird that people don't take those sort of basic simple rules, just create all of this fog out there, all of these abstractions like the state and the social contract and the social safety net, create all of these abstractions to hide what is elementally a very simple transaction, right? Gun to your head, pay the money.
People talk about the social contract as if a contract is, this implied contract, as if it's a concept. But, of course, contracts are real things. You can't say that this real thing is this imaginary thing. A contract is something that two people agree on.
Right, it has an objective
existence.
You can't
say a person is born with this contract because they're going to get a social security number.
Well, except for original sin, of course, which we all subscribe to.
Yes.
That is exactly the analogy I was going to make. It's exactly the same thing. Everyone is born selfish, so we all have to be bound to an original, to a social contract in order to ensure that we all. Because, you know, if we aren't bound by force, we're all going to die and live in chaos.
Well, that's an argument I heard on Penn Jillette's show where a dumb guy kind of said, you have to register for the draft because it's all part of that contract and you get all these benefits. So
And also, the benefits you get, the benefits you get from come solely from the fact that the government is a monopoly. I mean, because it imposes itself as the only agent that does, you know, roads and military and all this stuff. So
right.
It's not really a benefit, but it appears as if the state is the only thing capable of doing these things because no one else is doing them. But no one else is doing them because the government has a monopoly on them.
I know I'm not getting my Social Security money.
Anyway, we're kind of deviating here. But what I would say in your situation, Stefan, that you were talking about, I would go back to the geometric argument and talk about three people. You know, one person who has a broken leg or whatever, and then the other, a second person demands to a third person that he give him half of his money or resources to help feed the first person.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent approach. And the other thing that I would do is say that, you know, if you believe that some people are capable of morally creating implicit and violence-enforced obligations on behalf of other people, is that true for just a few people? Is that true for a lot of people? Or is it true for everyone? If it's true for everyone, then obviously the state having a monopoly is a bad idea. We should just sort of be all out there waving guns at people to get what we want. And if it's true for a lot of people but not other people, you have to sort of say where the line is between those who can do it and those who can't do it. Generally I find it's useful, it's the same way that it is with Christians or other religious people. Put the onus back on other people to prove stuff. I mean, The one things that libertarians are very prone to is that we run around trying to prove all of our theories. And I think that that is a big waste of time. I think that in order to engage the other person rather than have them keep shooting down the pigeons that we throw up in the air, just get them to prove their side of things, right? Just approach it from a situation of skepticism and say, you know, like, explain it to me like I'm 3 years old, because I've never had any luck understanding what people mean by social programs in the state. It's all too confusing for me. Like, speak to me like I'm drooling on myself and, you know, picking my nose, right? That I just don't understand. So what you're saying is, some people get to hold guns to other people because why? They're born. Like, help me understand the theory which justifies this, and put the onus back on the other person. I think it's time we got a whole lot lazier.
Exactly. Well, we are going to talk about the burden of proof, by the way. But your argument is more of a way of talking to people and try to make them understand how complex what they're seeing actually is. It's like people who see God created the universe. It's really simple to say, but what does it imply?
Right.
When you say the government does something, what does that imply? What are all the cause and effects here? Someone has to have a gun. Someone has to threaten someone else. Someone has to get the money. Someone has to administrate that money. Someone
right.
has to decide where the money's going to go, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, and I was having this discussion with a debate argument with a Christian the other day who was saying that, you know, the Christian God existed and so on. And I would say, well, I said something like, okay, so you understand, like, that human beings have come up with, like, 10,000 gods at least since the dawn of time, right? There's a whole bunch we know about, a whole bunch we don't know about. So of those 10,000 gods, 9,999 of which you believe are complete fantasies and don't exist, help me understand why I should look at the 10,000th god after dismissing 9,999 of them as complete fabrications. Help me to understand why I should come to the 10,000th one and say, oh, well, this one is real. It's just kind of funny, right?
Monotheists or atheists?
Did he give any reply?
Well, yeah, of course. He said it's a matter of faith.
Oh, there you go.
Or our guy said, they're all false gods.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
He believed in them, too, so.
Okay, right.
So, what we're going to do is we're going to go to the intermission. And when we come back, we are going to go through the moral argument and the geometric argument. Because there are a lot of people listening to this show who don't really know what market anarchy is. So what I would like us to do when we come back is maybe go through these things with them as if they were here. You understand what I mean?
Right.
I would like to go through this and go through the whole process. And after that, we can explain the model and the notion of arbitration and markets, etc. So for now, we're going to go to the intermission, and why don't you tell us what it's about?
Yeah, recently, I think it's on Fox, on the big story, John Gibson told us, told white people, that they had a duty to make babies, as Vladimir Putin has started paying his citizens to start making babies. But John Gibson says it's because dark people are making too many babies and light people aren't making enough babies. So I thought I'd let you guys listen to another sort of racist argument against immigration.
That is so true, though. We need to have more light-hued babies.
Light-hued babies.
It's because of sunlight.
But if you listen, you will see that he believes that Europeans and European-descended Americans, I guess, are too selfish and self-centered to have babies, which is rather curious, because I'm not really sure what unselfish reason there is to have a baby except to give it to someone else. So, we'll listen to him.
All right, we'll be right back.
It's time for intermission, boys and girls. Take a deep breath. Relax.
Now it's time for my word. Do your duty. Make more babies. That's the lesson drawn out of two interesting stories over the last couple of days. First, the story yesterday that half of the kids in this country under 5 years old are minorities. By far, the greatest number are Hispanic. Know what that means? 25 years and the majority population is Hispanic. Why is that? Well, Hispanics are having more kids, and others, notably the ones Hispanics called gabachos, white people, are having fewer. Now, in this country, European ancestry people, white people, are having kids at the rate that does sustain the population. It grows a bit. That compares to Europe, where the birth rate is in the negative zone. They're not having enough babies to sustain their population. Consequently, they're inviting in more and more immigrants every year to take care of things. And those immigrants are having way more babies than the native population, hence Eurabia. Why aren't they having babies? Because babies get in the way of a prosperous and comfortable modern life. Peanut butter fingerprints on the leather seats in the BMW. The Euros are in particular can't be bothered with kids. Underscore that second point. A second story today reports that Vladimir Putin is so concerned about the declining and imploding population of Russia, he is paying couples to have babies. Imagine, procreating for cash in Mother Russia. Putin has taken this step because at the rate things are going, Russia will lose close to 45 million in population in the next 45 years. Russia will be two-thirds of today's population. This is not a good trend for Russia. And it won't be here either if that should happen. Put it bluntly, we need more babies. Forget about that zero population growth stuff that my poor generation was misled on. Why is this important? Because civilizations need population to survive. So far, we're doing our part here in America, but Hispanics can't carry the whole load. The rest of you get busy. Make babies. Or put another way, a slogan for our times. Procreation, not recreation. That's my word.
Okay, intermission's over. The show must go on.
Oh, yes. Boy.
So next time you European Americans have sex, just think of John Gibson's face, and that will help you through.
Yeah, dear. The incentive. It's like I was telling you after we heard that. I was like, okay, having children is kind of a life decision. Are people going to change their minds on having children because of this guy? It's like, does he really think that...
Or because of economic trouble.
Does he really think that he's making a statement here that people are going to ponder his opinion in their life-changing decisions?
Well, but I mean, he would be he wouldn't be talking about the state if he thought he could actually change people's minds voluntarily.
Well, either way, he must have a fucking giant ego.
Right. Well, actually, that's a very weak ego, technically, right? Where you have to force other people to obey you.
Hmm. I suppose.
That's a conversation for another time. So,
Stefan, let's get to it. Let's get focused like a laser.
You bet.
What is the moral argument?
Well, the moral argument is to say that if you're going to say that there's such a thing as preferred behavior for human beings, right? Like, if you say, I think we should help the poor by shooting people who don't give money to the poor, and there's no ethics to it, it's just a state of nature, well, then obviously you're just sort of some crazy lunatic. But that's not what people ever do, right? Well, all they ever do is say, it's right, it's moral, it's good, it's ethical, you must because blah, blah, blah. So they start talking about preferred behavior for human beings. It's right to have a welfare state. It's right to have social security, the social safety net. It's good, it's kind, it's nice, it's virtuous. And that's fine. Then if you're going to start to talk about preferred behavior, then really, you're coming up with an ethical theory. And that seems to me entirely appropriate. We don't want to run society based on people's violent, random opinions, although it's generally what we do these days. It's not a good state of affairs. So if you are going to say that there's such a thing as ethics, and people should obey ethics because it's the right thing to do, or however you want to put it, that's perfectly legitimate. I think that's a great approach. But you can't just sort of say stuff, right? You have to be scientific. You have to be logical. You have to prove your case. You can't just sort of say, well, I don't like poor people on the street, so I think we should have a welfare state and put them in, like, subsidized apartments so they're out of sight, out of mind kind of thing, or whatever. If you're going to say that there's such a thing as ethics, that's great, fantastic, perfectly wonderful approach to solving social problems. But you can't then just attach the word ethics to all of your random opinions and say, this is what people have to do because it's right. You have to come up with a moral theory that is true for human beings. We have to have at least the standards of rigor that people have in the sciences when it comes to ethics, right? Because when things go wrong in ethics, like hundreds of millions of people get killed, So if things go wrong in science, all that happens is the theory fails or whatever, right? If things go wrong in ethics, then the state ends up with all this power, and you get wars, and you get starvation, and you get gulags, and you get torture. So it's, I think, let's at least reach for the basic kind of truth verification system that we have for the sciences, which is much less important than for ethics. Let's at least go for that. And that means, if you're going to have an ethical theory, it's got to be true for everyone. It's got to be true in all places. It can't sort of be true for this person and then have the exact opposite moral rules for someone else. Like, you can't in physics say, well, my theory predicts that this rock is going to fall down, but this rock is going to fall up. But that's not a theory. That's just a silly opinion, right?
Okay.
So you've got to have at least the basic scientific methodology of empiricism, of universality, of logic, of reciprocity, right? Like, if you say that it's good for me to do to somebody else, and it's got to be good for them to do it to me. It's got to be universal, and you can't appeal to these silly collectives, right? Like, if you're a physicist, you can't say, well, you see, rocks individually do this, but when you put rocks all together in a pile, they do the complete opposite, right? I mean, that would not be a physics theory. So that's all the argument for morality says, or the ethical approach to social problems is, by all means, let's have all the ethics in the world, but let's have them organized according to some consistent methodology and not just be a random grab bag of silly opinions.
Okay, all right. So now, could you go through a simple explanation? Like, suppose you are talking to someone who doesn't understand the moral issues. Why don't you go ahead and show us through the argument?
Do you want to play the devil's advocate, or should Andrew play the devil's advocate, and we'll sort of just hammer me as hard as you can with all the arguments we know?
Well, I think that we all have to contribute to the common good, the greater good of society.
Fantastic. Okay, so you're going to be the devil's advocate, right, and I'll try and be the valiant libertarian defender?
Sure, why not?
Okay, so you say we all need to contribute towards the common good, right?
Well,
and
sure,
I would... Sorry, go ahead.
Well, otherwise people would just be killing themselves in the street.
Okay, fantastic. Now, can you help me to understand what is the common good?
Well, it's what we all have to contribute to as part of society, so that society can better achieve its goals.
Well, but that's tautological, right? So you're saying the common good is that which makes the common thing better, but that hasn't really defined anything? Like, that's like saying, you say there's a sickness, what's the cure? Well, the cure is whatever makes the person better. It's like, well, sure. I mean, that's sort of understood, right? But what does it mean to say that society is bettered, or that the common good is achieved? Give me some tangible examples.
Well, if we can maybe reduce poverty or reduce war somehow.
Okay, that's fine. That's fantastic. Okay, so reduce poverty and reduce war. So if you have a theory which has certain kinds of effects, and those effects are like poverty gets reduced and war gets reduced, you would consider that to be for the better, right?
Sure.
Okay, so what you're saying is that ethics are going to be measured by the effect that they have on society.
Yeah, well, if things are getting better, then yeah, I guess that's the theory I would go with.
Fantastic. Okay, now, how are you going to determine ahead of time, right, because there's an infinite number of choices that we can make as a society. Let's just take the whole society thing for granted. I mean, I have problems with it, but let's just take it for granted for now. Obviously, there's about 6 billion decisions that societies can make. Help me to understand how we can know ahead of time that a certain decision is going to be better or worse, is going to make things better or worse. Like, if to treat cancer, you could do everything from hit someone on the head with a fry pan to fly them to Malaysia, to bury them in rocks, to what radiation treatments. You could do anything, right? But you have to have some methodology for trying to figure out whether or not what you propose as a cure, as an improvement in that person's health, is going to work or not. You don't just sort of randomly try everything. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay. So that's great. So you have a goal, which is the betterment of human society. Can you then help me understand how we will know whether or not what we're doing is going to do that or not?
Well, I guess you're going to have to look at the statistics and the evidence and find out if your theory is supported by the evidence.
Well, I would say that that's an interesting approach, but the problem is that because we can do 6 billion different things to deal with particular issues, I would say that the problem that you're going to have is we really can't as a society, and I think you'd pretty much agree with this, we can't as a society try 6 billion different things and then measure the statistics to see which works. Would that be fair?
Yeah.
Okay, so we have to have some way of whittling down what it is that we're going to do ahead of time so that we don't just randomly try everything.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is why we have to base our societal decisions on our culture and such.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that so far. I think you're sort of saying that there's a methodology for determining society's decisions, which is based on a methodology for determining society's decisions. Like, we should appeal to culture, which is how we make decisions, in order to know how to make decisions. I think that's sort of begging the question. So let's just start with a complete blank slate. And you say you want society to become better. How are we going to know, of the 6 billion things we can do or not do, how are we going to know which ones are going to be beneficial and which ones aren't?
I don't know. I guess we're going to have to do some of them.
I agree we're going to have to do some of them, but which ones are we going to do?
Man, this is hard.
Okay, you guys, this is getting a little...
Yeah.
All convoluted here.
Well, yeah, I don't think so. I think this is effective, because I think what it's doing is having someone try and explain exactly what it is that they're talking about, mm-hmm. and putting the onus upon them, as we were talking about earlier, right?
I understand.
Yeah.
It's very well illustrated. But what I mean is, I think we should go through the short of the argument, which is basically, you take an example. For example, someone supports gun control. So you ask them, okay, so you don't want anyone to have guns, and then he says, no, I think policemen should have guns, soldiers should have guns.
Do you want me to try being the devil's advocate, and you respond to the gun argument?
All right, sure.
Okay, so, Francois, you evil NRA card-carrying sociopath. And I've been waiting to say that for a long time, no, I'm kidding. So, yes, I believe that we should have control over guns in society, because it's absolutely, the proliferation of guns increases crime, destabilizes society, makes people frightened, children get killed accidentally, people get shot accidentally, people who aren't trained on guns don't even know how to use them effectively, you're more likely to harm yourself than to harm any kind of criminal, blah, 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 blah. There should be controls on guns. I'm not saying they should be eliminated completely, but we should have some kind of controls on them.
Okay, so who should be allowed to have guns?
Well, the decision about who is allowed to have guns is something that society should decide on as a whole. Like, everyone is allowed to have some guns. I'm just saying we shouldn't have, like, you know, submachine guns and rocket launchers and nuclear bombs and so on. There's some limit on the amount of weaponry that a citizen should be allowed to have. And I include the police in that as well.
Okay, this is not really what I had in mind for this argument, because now you are veering into the issue of...
Well, we have to assume that we're going to be debating people who are good, right? Because if people are bad, they're easy to defeat, right? So we have to assume that we're going to be debating the people who are good.
We're always going to bring up democracy.
Well, I'm just saying that they don't usually know.
Really?
I'm just saying now the issue is veering into the democracy, so now we would have to talk about the issue of some people voting against... I just want to present the general structure of the argument.
What if the devil's advocate said, I believe that it's every taxpayer's duty to support education for everyone in the country, because it's the cornerstone of everything good in the country, to have an educated populace.
Do you want to try the same sort of devil's advocate position with me, Ellie, and I'll try and defend
you guys are wrong? Doing the devil's advocates after devil's advocates.
I know.
I think it's useful, though, because I've always found that listening to people debate the issues as it is that I debate them with people can be really helpful, because to know the abstract is one thing. To know how to swing people's perspectives around is quite a different thing. So I think that actually can be helpful.
Well, I'm just saying that in your response about gun control, you talk about democracy, so we would have to get into that issue, the issue of democracy and having some people vote to take other people's rights.
Well, sure, you can do that for sure, or there are ways of bypassing the whole question around about democracy as well.
Okay, how would you do that?
Okay, Ali, do you want to ask me the question on... education.
Not go anywhere today.
Don't worry about it. Let's try it. I think that educating everyone in America, let's say America, is our duty, and if we don't educate everyone, regardless of how much money they have, then the country will probably crumble.
Right, okay. So this is an argument from effect, right? Mm-hmm. That's the first thing to sort of categorize what it is that the person is doing to make their case, right? So in this case, somebody is saying that the country will be worse off if everybody is not educated by the state, right? So it's an argument from effect. And that, I mean, that's the first thing I would do is sort of classify it from that standpoint. And then you can choose to one of two approaches. You can either respond to it as an argument from effect. And you can say, for instance, that do you feel that everyone is being well educated now? Do you feel there are any improvements that could be possible within the system? Do you feel that parents are satisfied? Do you think that the rate of graduation is good? Do you feel that there's any problem with the fact that schools cost three times what they did 30 years ago, but the schools, the scores have not improved? Do you think that the amount of national debt that is going on at the moment, that is obviously going to end up with schools being completely bankrupt and then there being no education for anyone, is the right approach? I mean, you can deal with it as an argument from effect up front, and that's a good debate to get into with people, right? If somebody feels that universal education is good, then obviously an educational system which goes into debt is not good, because it's eventually going to run out of money, then there'll be no education for anyone, right? So that's one way that you can approach the issue. The other way that you can approach the issue is to say something like, look, I appreciate what you're saying and I understand it, kind of, but fundamentally I don't understand it, and that's not because you're not being clear, it's because I have like a mental block, which maybe you can help me through, but I have real trouble understanding all these generic arguments about society and so on. Like, maybe you can help me just break it down into something more simple, right? So you got some kid, and that kid has to be educated, and so somebody has to do what? How do you ensure that that person gets educated, that kid gets educated? What's your process?
Ah. Okay, I had a hard time hearing you there, but...
Well, the question is just help me break it down. Instead of talking about children and the country and society as a whole, we've got a kid, and how are you going to make sure that that kid gets educated?
Okay, so the kid needs to be able to go to his neighborhood school, and it's funded through taxes.
Okay, I got it. So you feel that the way that a child must be educated, or the way the child should be educated, is to force people to educate that child, and then if they are not... if they don't want to participate in that, or if they want to set up their own school, or if they want to fund it in a different kind of way, are they allowed to do that or not? Like, if I want to set up my own school and educate the kids, even for free, in my own neighborhood, am I allowed to do that, or is it just the government?
Well, the government has to have strict controls over that, because we need to have accountability to make sure that the home and community schooling is doing it properly and not run by a bunch of crackpots.
Fantastic. Okay, so then the criteria for you for success in a school system is accountability, which would mean sensitivity to the needs of the parents.
Children need to have basic standards of education so that they can go into university equally prepared.
Got it. Okay. So for you, you feel that the best way to get accountability is to force people to pay for a system that they have no say in.
Well, don't you think that that it should be fair? Everyone should pay the same amount because after all, the children will be the future leaders and business owners of the country.
Well, yeah, but you I mean, I appreciate that. That's a great speech, but we're still trying to deal with not with the big sort of abstractions like a country and so on, but with really specific things, right? So if you feel that the criteria for success in a school system is accountability to the consumer, right? Accountability to the patient, to the parents, and to the children, then explain to me how forcing people to pay for a school system which they may or may not approve of or want or like or respect or find helpful, how does that increase accountability? Because that's sort of the problem that I have with these kinds of systems. One of the problems that I have.
Well, somebody has to decide what a good standard of education is, and most people don't know.
Okay, fantastic. Now, if most people don't know, do you think that they should have any input then? If I have kids and I have no idea how to educate them, do you think I should have any input in the school system? Wouldn't any input just be kind of silly then?
Well, that's why we have PTA.
You mean that's why we have specialists in the government?
We have parent-teacher associations. So perhaps each school should have organizations where the parents can have input.
Okay, and wouldn't you say, though, that if the parents have input, that there's going to be lots of problems because everyone does have a different idea. I mean, we're a multicultural society, right? Everyone has a different idea about how their children should be educated, right? We have Christians, we have atheists, we have Muslims, we have all of these different groups within society, every one of which has a different idea of how their child should be educated. So if everybody's put into one system, help me understand how everyone's going to be able to agree on how that's going to work.
Well, you have school boards where they decide by voting.
Right. Okay, so what you're saying, so now we're back to the, and this is great, I mean, we're really making progress here. Now we're back to the idea that the majority vote gets to impose its will on the minority, and that's really the only way that it can work, as far as you're concerned, right?
Well, everyone has to lose a little so everyone can gain, I guess.
Sure, I understand. So what you're saying is that a good model for making social decisions is for the majority to have the right, in a sense, to impose its will on the minority.
Well, I guess that's what democracy is, isn't it?
Got it. Okay. So that's a really good way of making social decisions. Is that fair to say?
It's the best way that we have.
Fantastic. Look, this is great. We're almost done now because this is a wonderful, wonderful principle, right? Now, if the majority imposing its will on the minority is by far the best way of making social decisions, then help me understand why we shouldn't make all social decisions that way. So, for instance, if you have a grocery store in your neighborhood, surely there should be a grocery store / neighborhood board where everyone gets to vote on the food that's in that grocery store and the prices and this and that. Like, and also, if somebody wants to get married, surely their community should get together and vote for them who it is that they have to marry, and so on. So it seems to me that if the majority rule is the best way of making decisions in society, then I'm not sure I understand why it wouldn't be great for every single situation that you could possibly come up with.
Wow, that's a great point. I wouldn't want the community to decide who I can marry and not marry. Maybe that's why we have the Constitution and checks and balances to make sure that we're not oppressed.
Yes, but so that's totally fine. So let's say that you have some limits on who the community can force you to marry, right? So they can't force you to marry somebody who's dead, right? Or they can't force you to marry somebody who's a drug addict or something like that. So there's some limits, right? But other than that, who it is that you get to marry should be absolutely open to communal decisions. And I think that it would be fair to say that how a child gets educated, right, how their mind gets formed, how their ideas get shaped, how their perceptions get developed, is easily as important a decision in society as who somebody marries. And certainly we can see that people make bad decisions in marriages all the time, right? So we should absolutely have, I think, social controls on something like marriage or sexual partnerships or business partnerships or anything that you like. I think that if you want to buy a house, the community should get together and vote which house you get and where and so on. And if there's somebody already there and the community wants to change the ownership, the community should have the ability to do that because, as you said earlier, democracy is the best way of making decisions in any kind of context.
Wow, that sounds terrible. Well, personally, I would say, wow, you have a really great point, and I have some things to think about, but the other half of my mind thinks that somebody would say, no, no, you can't say that. That's different.
And that's fine, and that would be a great... See, we're having a fun discussion, right? Nobody's yelling and calling names or anything. But and I'm trying to just sort of understand where somebody's coming from. This is the curiosity. Like, I want to make sure that I understand your moral theory. And if somebody said that's different, that would be great, fantastic. Now you can really start to help me. Explain to me why it's different.
I think that this little conversation has been useful in, you know, just sort of explaining to people how these conversations go. But I don't know, can we sort of get to some of the principles behind it, you know, about individuals versus concepts and such?
Well, yeah, I think that we can sort of tease, at least I can help tease the points out that I was trying to make in the discussion, which is that if somebody has a moral theory, right, you have to, when somebody says schools should be run by society or whatever, right, they have a moral theory at the back of that, and that's what you have to try and get them to express, right? So when I was talking to Ali, I'm like, okay, so is it because society is better, and the same thing I was doing with you, Andrew, right? What is the moral theory that lets you say things like, people should do this, or people should do that, or this is better than something else? There's a moral theory back there somewhere. And in Ali's case, it was that society is, the decisions are best made by the collective imposing its will on the individual. Right, that's the moral principle, right? And then you say, okay, well, if that's a moral principle, then we need to universalize it, right? And we need to sort of say, okay, if that's the best way of making decisions, then surely all decisions should be made that way, right? I mean, scientists say that the scientific method is the best way of determining whether a scientific theory is valid. Fantastic. Then all scientific theories should be subject to the scientific method, right? You don't have sort of one group of scientists out there doing testing and experimentation and another group out there sort of smoking LSD and praying for answers, right? You have to sort of say there's one methodology that's common. Or if they are, I'd sure love to read those papers because I bet you they'd be pretty trippy. But so what you want to do is when somebody comes up with a moral proposition, you want to kind of peel the onion and get to what the moral premise is at the bottom. Right? This is the Socratic method, right? And then what you want to do is you want to apply that moral theory to other situations. And if the person doesn't like the application of the moral theory to other situations, which is what Ali found when we said that people should have to marry those that the community says they should marry, then obviously there's a problem with the moral theory, and it can't be if it can't be universalized, it's problematic, right? So if I have a moral theory, a physics theory, which says all these rocks fall down, but somewhere over there I find that rocks fall up, there's a problem. My theory can't be universalized. So you want to get to the moral theory that's behind what the person's saying, and then apply it to other situations. And if they don't like the way it happens in other situations, then obviously the moral theory is flawed. Is that sort of where you came to, Ali?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I was trying to act, of course, but
you did a great job.
I have been in that situation. That is definitely what my family believes.
Sure, absolutely, for sure. For sure, and everybody appeals to these... Everybody appeals to these moral absolutes, and that's great,
well,
right? But they have to then say it's good everywhere. Otherwise, it's not a moral theory. It's just a silly opinion.
I tend to think that a lot of these people are relativists, so it's kind of hard to you know, hammer them down to any kind of moral universalism because they fundamentally disagree with moral realism.
You don't have to talk about morality.
Yeah.
Using the moral argument is simply saying, listen, you're in favor of this kind of government intervention. Okay, for example, gun control. You think that only policemen and soldiers should have guns. Okay, but why? How does that work? Well, because policemen and soldiers need to protect themselves from criminals. Yes, but don't we all need to protect ourselves from criminals?
That's what the police are for.
So why do some, and like Stefan says on his podcast, what's the difference between me and a policeman? Is it the uniform? Is it when he puts on his uniform, does he suddenly have more rights?
That's exactly the point, is that we're looking for a theory of morality that is universal in application. So
exactly.
What thoughts do you have on that, Stefan?
A theory of morality that is universal in application? Well, the basic difference is that what's sometimes called a negative injunctions, right, in sort of theories of morals, a thou shalt not rather than a thou shalt, right? So if you say everybody has to jump out of bed and sing a particular song in the morning, right, that's a thou shalt, and obviously that's going to be impossible to either enforce or contemplate. And if you say that people should not initiate the use of violence against others, then that is a moral theory that can be universally applied.
I'm going to have to cut you here for a second. We, for our listeners on Free Thought Radio, we are now going to end our first hour here. Here. So, goodbye, and if you want to listen to the rest of the show, come on helboundalley.com.
Yeah, and you can send us an email at allie@hellboundalley.com later.
Sorry, we're gone. And we're back. We're now going in our second hour.
This one just feels totally different.
It feels really second hour-y. I know.
See, the morals on this hour don't apply to the morals on the first hour.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So the general argument is to say, well, if you support this or that government program, you have to explain how come some people get to use force on other people, or how come some people have rights that other people don't. The basic fact is that everyone, if it applies to one person, then it should apply to everyone, because the reasons apply to everyone. And then when you go through this and you come to the state, you look at the state and say, how come a group of people call themselves the state and they have the right to steal from you and kill you and basically enslave you, which is called the draft, and you can't do that? What's the difference between these people and you?
I think that's good. And I think another thing to do with the argument from democracy, there's two things which I've sort of found helpful, and one of which Ali just experienced, right? If you're talking to a woman about this kind of stuff, I think generally it can be helpful to try and sort of figure out what might be meaningful to a woman or to a man or to anyone that you're talking to, right? And so I think with Ali, I tried a couple of arguments, and then the one I think that really connected was the one about marriage, right? And so that can be sort of helpful as well. You have to find some situation where that sort of democratic rule is really unpalatable to someone. And it's going to be different for different people, but that can be helpful in terms of figuring that out. The other thing you can do with the argument around democracy or the majority is to say, okay, well, if the majority should decide for the minority, there should be no limit to that, right? So basically the ideal democracy, the perfect democracy, would be the world. Right, so every time you had to make a decision, you'd have to go on the internet, submit your decision, everyone would have to vote on it. And, you know, because why would it just be one country? Because if it can be one country, can't it be one city? Can't it be one town? Can't it be one house, right? One house with three roommates is also could be considered a society, right?
Yeah.
So if you can't find some way to limit where democracy lands and doesn't land, unless you just create this arbitrary line in the map like a country, then again, you have a problem sort of saying, what changes if two people decide for one person and then the decision reverses? What has changed in reality? Isn't it just that we're saying that everyone should be a slave to the opinion of the majority?
Exactly. So that's the moral argument in a nutshell. And
I don't know. It's just that people really believe that the only way to have your values work in the state is to have a vote. You know, and I guess you open a whole new bottle of worms. I guess you're going to have to look that one up, too.
Can of worms.
Absolutely.
They think that everyone gets their values met because they're able to go and vote.
Right, and that's why if you... And we're so conditioned to thinking about that in terms of political decisions, like healthcare, like education, like taking care of the poor, and so on. That's where the propaganda has completely blown people's minds. Like, they can't even reason in that kind of situation, because they've had all this school propaganda, it's all in the movies, and the intellectuals keep repeating the same thing, and so on. So what you need to do is, you need to lift that situation out of where it's familiar, right? Like, forget about talking about the welfare programs and so on. I mean, I think Francois's point earlier is excellent, right? You just talk about a house, talk about a neighborhood, talk about you and your friends, talk about this, that, or the other, right? And you can also ask someone, just in general, like, if they feel that majority rule is the really important way to make decisions, ask them how that shows up in their personal life, right? So if you're interested in dating some guy and you sort of, but you're undecided, do you go to your friends and have them vote on it? Like, do you actually apply this, or is this just something that's really abstract for you, or do you actually apply this in your personal life? Because if they don't, it's kind of hypocritical, right? To say that, oh, for educating children, we should go to the majority, but when it comes to me figuring out which job I should take, I don't go and ask people to vote on it. I make my own decision, right? It's kind of hypocritical to have these two.
We make those decisions based on fact and not some kind of belief.
Yeah, I mean, people do set up these weird moral universes which are completely separate for how they live their life, right? So one of the arguments that I use with people as well, if they say to me that, you know, a nonviolent society can't work, right? And so I generally say to them something like, so I guess what you're saying is that you're confessing to having held guns to people's heads to make them do what you want, in which case I think you're a pretty scary individual, right? And they'll say, well, what are you talking about? And I say, well, you say that things can't work unless you use violence. So obviously you know this from your own personal experience, so you must have used a lot of violence to get your way in your own life. And they say, are you crazy? I've never held a gun to anyone's head. It's like, oh, so for your life, nonviolence works. But for other people's lives, it's never going to work. Like, help me understand that. That's not how you live, right?
Yeah.
It's so easy to just... this stuff, you have to really work hard to make it complicated. It's really kind of simple. Right?
I'm not very good at making things personal. It always gets...
There's a very strong belief in people that we have original sin.
Sure.
That we're born too selfish to live in society. That we need to be forced to live together.
Mm-hmm. No, I've heard that one too.
And so when you ask this person, so you don't care about other people, correct? And they say, no, I do care about other people.
But nobody else does.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're the only moral person in the world.
Right. In which case, you can't have a democracy, right? If the majority
exactly.
of people are evil, then you certainly... If the majority of people are evil, you can never have a democracy because they're just going to vote in...
You can't have a state.
You can't have a state. No, of course, because the majority of people are going to be evil and they're going to have a monopoly of power. Surely, that's worse than anything.
Exactly.
I mean, if everyone's evil, the best we can hope for is a sort of armed neutrality state of nature situation. So I just think it's kind of funny to say that there's such a thing as evil in the world, and it's a big enough problem that we need to give a bunch of people who could be evil a complete monopoly of power.
Exactly.
I mean, it just seems completely ridiculous to me.
If you're good, and most of the people you care about are good... Why would that person assume that without a government...
Because it's the belief in the original sin.
Well, I mean, there are people out there who say, look, if I didn't believe in God, I'm going to go out and rape people.
Exactly. Exactly. It's the exact same argument.
Right, right.
But
sure.
You know they don't really mean that.
No, it's the exact same argument.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to talk about the geometric argument. Do you want to get into that, Andrew? You haven't sent much yet.
Yeah, I guess. I'm not sure exactly how it goes. I think you'd be probably better at it.
Well, the argument is fundamentally, you start with three people. And you say, suppose that we're just three people.
Okay. So I broke my leg and I need health care, for example. I need to go to a hospital.
Yeah, you could use that as an example, yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly the specific of how one... I suppose it depends on your goal in using the argument. For example, if someone is for social welfare, you could say, well, suppose that one of the three people is not as good as the others in making the crops or whatever, or he has a broken leg, whatever, and I go to you and I... put a gun to your head and tell you, okay, you better give me half of your crops so that I can feed this other guy or I'll kill you. And so you can talk about the morality of that situation. And the
Well, if you take a very simple example like that where it's just, you know, two people involved and the one person comes to the other one and says, well, you have to give me half of your money so that I can... provide crops for you, you know, it's quite
right.
easy to see that it really doesn't make sense because, you know, on top of that, the guy's going to take some overhead and then, you know, what incentive does he actually have to actually give the guy the crops that he says he's going to and all these problems. And then basically the argument just expands from that and it says, well, you know, if it's bad for one person to take half of your crops, you know, and then tell you that they're going to give you something in return,
right.
you know, why should it be good for two people or, you know, how many people does it have to be for it to become good?
Exactly, and then the geometric part is you keep growing the example. You go
right, so we'll just keep adding one person at a time to the example, and then you tell me the point at which it becomes good to start stealing.
And why? Like, not like 100 to 101 people, it's like somebody can sort of put their stake in the ground and say, now it becomes moral. And it's like, fascinating, tell me why. What has changed in reality, right?
Exactly, and another thing is that person... you shouldn't mention that. That person who has the gun calls himself the state or the leader.
Right. And another thing, this argument from geometry, and I've still been meaning to do this, but I haven't gotten around to doing it yet, just sort of like a video cast. What I find really helpful with stuff in philosophy is use stuff that's on the table, right? So you're sitting at someone with a restaurant, right? So you can get your salt and pepper shakers, you can get whatever, the rings that hold the napkins or whatever, and just put them in the middle, right? And you can get, let's just say you got a chess set candy or a dinner party or something, there's a chess set around. So you put sort of one pawn out in the middle of the table. You say, okay, this is one individual, this is like a pawn, right? It has particular properties made of wood or whatever, right? Okay, so then I'm going to add another one. Now we have two. Has anything changed to the first one's characteristics? Like, is it suddenly now a pawn and a half? Is it suddenly, like, made of some other... Does it have an aura? Like, has it changed? No, of course not. All that's happened is you've got another one next to it. And you just keep adding things, and you say, okay, well, tell me when the nature of each one of these specific items changes based on its proximity to some other item. And, of course, that never happens, right? So then you can sort of say, this is why when you talk about the social good or the collective or society or the country or the class or the race, it doesn't mean anything to me. It doesn't mean anything. What we're talking about is individual things, and you can't suddenly say that when they get together, somehow the properties of all of them change. It doesn't make any sense. And I find using physical props that way, people get so lost in these cloudy abstractions of the social good, and but just get them back to the physical, get them back to the individuals. The best way I found to do that is I could actually line up batteries and pens and like just help me understand what changes when you put a bunch of these things together.
You need to be in a diner to do it.
You need to be in a diner. Well, you need to have one of those pocket chess sets so to kick it around.
Yeah.
Now,
I was thinking at this point maybe we could start to talk a little bit about just the model of what a market anarchy society might look
like.
Yes. And I think what's useful to sort of start this argument off is just to, again, you know, bring it back to just two or three people and make it a very simple situation. And, of course, what we're talking about here is, you know, we want a society that is not based on the use of force to achieve your goals. So if you're not going to use force, then you have to use voluntary trade. And, you know, if we want to just give a real simple example, you can just think of, you know, the old example that I'm sure you probably heard about in your social science course at some point, you know, that somebody has baskets and then somebody else has wheat or whatever the product is. And, you know, they basically... You know, each person wants each other's products, and instead of stealing them from each other, they are going to voluntarily trade.
Well, sure. I mean, you could do that, but my suggestion, Andrew, just try it on. I don't know if it'll work or not, but the thing that I found helpful is I don't think you need to appeal to anything abstract about this at all, because anybody that you're discussing this stuff with is not a criminal. I mean, I'm assuming you're not sort of having this conversation with somebody as they're actually holding you up, right? Because then the argument for morality might not be too gripping for them, right? But if you're sort of, let's say you're talking to some public school teacher, right? And when you talk about an anarcho-capitalist society, when you talk about a society of pacifism, you say you're speaking to some nice lady who's a public school teacher, you say, okay, well, an anarcho-capitalist society is going to kind of look exactly like your life does. It's exactly the same. There's no abstract, no need to go to Somalia, there's no need to go to Iceland in the 16th century or to, you know, the jungle with the state of nature and the pitch and the property rights, whatever. It's your life. Right? So when you got your job, did you hold a gun to the guy's head and say, if you don't hire me, I'm going to pull the trigger? Of course not. Unless you went and you offered a benefit to them and they offer a benefit to you, it's voluntary. Like when you met your husband, did you say, if you don't marry me, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to saw your leg off or something, right? Of course not, right? You benefit to him, benefit to you, voluntary interaction trade. Everybody's life, except for a cop's and a soldier's, everybody's life is a perfect anarcho-capitalist situation, in my sort of humble opinion. So I don't think you need to go real abstract. I think you just need to say, how do you live? Like, do you solve your problems by pulling out a gun? Or do you solve your problems by reasoning?
10-year-old in the public school.
Right. Well, but even they don't get their marks, usually, by holding a gun to the teacher's head, right?
I always think of kids and their, like, baseball cards or their trading cards and marbles and stuff, at least when I was a kid, as being sort of a anarcho-capitalist thing. Do they care when they're selling their lemonade about, you know, paying fees to the government to do it?
Right, although there have been instances of the government shutting down lemonade stands. I think I've actually saw an article on that.
Yeah, it's actually happened.
Yeah.
But I mean, that to me is just, the morality is really simple. I mean, and it takes a lot of work to really make it complicated. But people's lives are exactly what it is that we're talking about. All we're talking about is saying, look, if you don't use violence to solve your problems, like at a personal level, if you don't pull out a gun or a knife or threaten to drive over somebody's gardenias if they don't agree with you, if you don't use violence in your own life, isn't it kind of hypocritical to say that other people should use violence when you're not willing to do that? Like, if violence is a good thing to use, you should use it so that you know what you're talking about. And if it's not a good thing to use, then you should damn well stop telling other people they should use it.
Exactly.
It seems like there is a certain amount of people who rely on violence, but I guess they would be in the minority. I mean, I've seen it before, people who and have violent domestic situations and are always relying on the cops to solve their problems, or neighbors who can't seem to get along.
Sure, but I think even those people would not say that this is a universal good, right? I don't think these people would have a theory that says everybody should beat their partner, right? I think that they would, if you would say to these people, if you could snap your fingers and not have this happen in your life, would you do
right.
that? They would say, yeah, I would do that, right? And so, to me, that those people aren't the people that we're debating with from a situation of morality. I mean,
yeah.
Those people are trapped in their own nightmarish hells based on their childhoods and their lack of sort of self-knowledge, but those aren't people putting forth universal moral theories. Those are the intellectuals and the teachers and so on, right? I mean, not that those people can't also be abusers, but they wouldn't put that forward as part of their moral theory, I don't think.
Another great example to give to atheists is science. Because, do I have to explain it?
Because atheists tend to say that...
No, I mean, the whole structure of science is based on voluntary exchange.
Sure, I don't think that you're going to be the most popular scientist if you do an experiment and it comes up with some data, and then you just tell the other scientists that they have to accept your conclusions.
Or
you're going to shoot them. Yeah.
Or you're going to shoot them.
Or maybe all the scientists should get together and vote on it.
Exactly.
But you see, this is kind of funny, right? I mean, as soon as you take this democratic example to something that's based on reality, as if ethics are not based on reality. But the problem is everybody thinks ethics is based on sort of God and ghosts and goblins and so on, so it's tough for them to connect it to tangible reality. But yeah, you take an example like that and you say, well, scientists should vote on which scientific theories are true, and they should also vote on which scientific theories are true based on bribes, right? Because when you talk about something like the way democracy works, right? Everybody thinks like you're sort of marching around throwing shekels or sort of seashells into a pile objectively. That's not the case at all, right? You have in public school, you have an enormous number of people who depend on the state for their employment, right? All of the principals and a lot of the teachers would not be around if it were privatized. They sure as heck wouldn't get 2 months off in the summer and only have to work, 6 hours a day for 4 days a week for the remainder of it. But, the fact that people get bribed is also pretty significant, right? So, you would say that democracy, even if it were an ideal way of solving problems, if everybody was purely objective and well-educated and understood the short- and long-term benefits of this, that, and the other, that would be a stronger argument, not a clincher, but a stronger argument for democracy. But the fact is that most people are bribed when it comes to democracy. Like if you get out of your head in the clouds and deal with the actual facts, right? People get voted in because they can bring a lot of money to their home districts, right? The unions give a lot of money to the political parties so that the political parties will raise the minimum wage and keep the immigrants out and, fund them and so on, right? So even if we say democracy is great in an ideal sense, the way that it works in the real world is people just get bribed. And also because they've gone through public school, they're not taught a lot about the basics of government, so they don't understand. So there's just so many ways to approach undermining that argument from democracy that you can sort of come at many different angles.
The market anarchist model, I like to go in it from the perspective of value systems and incentives. And the state is a monopoly of force. Well, I don't. That's not my definition, but it doesn't matter. The state enforces a singular value system on an entire population by force. And that value system is determined by a lot of very bad incentives. I mean, you can get into, like you were saying, bribes, basically, which is how do you call them?
Lobbies?
Yeah, well, not just lobbies, but financing people's elections. And,
sure.
You know what I
interest
mean.
Interest groups and...
Yeah, exactly. And the ability of people to scam large groups of people into believing them and using common beliefs and all that sort of thing to enforce a value system which is translated into a monopoly called the law, which really has nothing to do with reality. And so the market anarchist model is that everyone has different values, value systems. And everyone should be free to express them and to deal with other people who want to help them do that.
Right, and right.
And force order should not be forcibly produced extremely inefficiently, like any monopoly. And by the way, this is another thing. I don't understand why people don't grasp that the inefficiency of a monopoly and the immorality of a monopoly, which most people understand very well, but they don't seem to connect that to the state.
Hmm.
The state is the biggest monopoly there is.
Right. Like
did someone was going to say something?
No, I'm just agreeing, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, I don't get that. I think that's another point we should talk about. But,
well, someone asked you just the other day,
yeah.
I don't see how Francois Tremblay has really looked at corporations and how they take freedom away from people like he does the government. How I don't see any difference with the, you know, he's saying that you're probably a Republican because he doesn't see the difference between the government taking freedom from people and big corporations taking freedom from people.
The big difference between the government and the corporation is that the government is not accountable.
Right.
The government is a monopoly of force.
And is not accountable. It's not accountable to anyone but itself. So
right, and this is something else that I also find kind of funny, right? Because people have this suspicion of corporations, which to some degree is justified to the degree with which those corporations are involved in sort of mercantilist state coercive activities. But if I sort of said to people, okay, well, let's just say that you wanted to create a great situation where people could choose any kind of car they want, would it be the case that you would then set up, say, General Motors to educate those children for 8 hours a day for 14 years on how great General Motors cars were, and, you know, if they didn't buy General Motors cars and tell everyone back exactly how great those cars were, then they would get flunked out and their whole forward momentum in society would be arrested and so on. Would you say that that'd be a situation where people could objectively choose whether or not General Motors cars were better? And also, let's just say then, that also General Motors didn't only teach the kids about how great their cars were for 14 years, but also they never allowed any other cars to exist. Like, would you then be in a state where people could choose their own cars? And people would say, well, no, of course not. It's like, well, isn't that exactly the same with the state, right? I mean, the public education. And I mean, they have trouble understanding these sort of basic things, right? I mean, if it's not good for corporations to do, why would it be good for a government to do? It's just people, and people are people, right?
Exactly. Very good example. And the basic principle is that in a market anarchy, everyone is accountable. Because if you provide a service and I don't like your service, I'm going to go buy it from someone else. If you don't like what I do, you're not going to hire me. You're not going to buy my products.
Right.
Every single person in market anarchist system is accountable to each other. But in the statist system, how is the government accountable to me? Through democracy? the democracy is not accountability. For one thing, I don't have any... For one thing, I can't decide not to have a state. I can't decide to make any other choice but those that are presented to me.
People,
how is that accountability?
People figure it's accountability because they think that if the politician doesn't do what you want, you're going to not vote for him.
Right,
well,
right.
It doesn't change the fact that he's going to be reelected or not.
No.
the fact that he's going to be reelected or not is going to depend on the common beliefs propagated by the media about that person, and how that interacts with the beliefs of other people. It has not that I individually have no say in what happens in government.
And right, and I mean, even if you were to take this to a sort of free market example and sort of use the car one again, you'd say, well, would you consider it a free market if you had to buy a car from General Motors, but every 4 years you could choose to buy a different model?
Exactly.
Right? Would that be a free market? Well, people would say, well, of course not. Well, what do I do in the intervening 3 years, 4 years, if the car breaks down? Sorry, you have to wait for four. If your car breaks down after 6 months, you get 3.5 years of waiting for your next car, and then they'll maybe sell you another one with your own money, because you have to pay twice. And people pretty quickly recognize that that would not be a free market situation in cars, but they just don't see it when it comes to the government. It takes a lot of education to make people blind to this obvious stuff.
So what you have in the market anarchy is you've got people trading for all the services that are currently very inefficiently, very immorally enforced by the state today. So you would have all roads would be private, all police would be private, all courts would be private. And most of these things, if not all, have existed and flourished before the intervention of government, of democracy, especially. The rise of democracy destroyed a lot of these private endeavors and took them over. But what we have basically is a system where people trade for these services and get the benefit of competition and accountability. And what you have is, because people express their value system, there is going to be disagreement. And the way the state solves these disagreements today is there's one law, and we all have to fight each other to dictate what that law is going to be. So what it creates is social warfare, and that's pretty much the whole result of it. It's social warfare, and whoever is culturally accepted or received belief is going to be enforced on everyone. In a market anarchy, we treat people like adults. We say, if you want your value system, you're free to follow your value system and find other people who wish to follow it and to protect yourself according to it. Now, what happens when there's friction between my value system and yours? Well, we have to sit at a table and we have to talk about it. We have to negotiate terms by which we're going to interact in society. In market anarchy, that's called arbitration. So, for example, if you buy your services from company A and another person buys court services or whatever, security protection from company B, well, company A and B are going to sit together and they're going to figure out, well, if one of your guys... one of my customer kills one of your customers, or vice versa, we're not just gonna let him go scot-free. Because it's not in their interest to do that, because if I'm a customer and I find out that my agency or company negotiated terms saying that people from that other company can kill you all they want, well, I'm going to switch. I'm not going to want to stay in an agency that gives me bad terms. So,
and I think one of the great fears, and it's an unconscious fear, but I think it's a very real one, that people have about a truly free society is that they kind of know deep down that they're not really worth what it is that they're giving out. Right? So I would say that the people who are the most unattractive from a personal level are the ones most into arranged marriages. Like people who are, benevolent stud muffins or something, they're probably quite comfortable with the idea of choosing your own partner because they're going to be in demand, right? But I think it's a very much a low self-esteem issue that fundamentally, as I always talk about, comes back to the family, right? Did you ever feel like you were valuable to your parents, or did you feel they were just kind of putting up with you or whatever, right? But I think when people think about a truly free society where they can't ever rely on coercion to get people to deal with them, they have to actually provide value in every single interaction, they feel very uncomfortable with that at a very fundamental level. And I think that's where you want, that's why I always say, you know, okay, well, how are things with your parents, right? And if somebody says, oh, my parents, they completely ignored me, they never seemed to want to have anything to do with me, and they just sort of tolerated me, well, then there's somebody here, I think, who's going to be having a lot graver difficulties dealing with something like market anarchy. But if you just keep it at the political level, I don't think it'll ever be clear what is going on.
All right. Yeah, I understand that, but I mean, it's kind of hard to deal with people's personal issues.
Sure, I know.
You can't really go out there and solve everyone's family life. I think to a certain extent we have to accept that people are going to have to deal with that themselves. You know, we can.
I agree, but it can be very useful in terms of figuring out who you can deal with and who you can't. Like, it's important to, as somebody said on the boards today, at least the Free Domain Radio boards, that you want to make sure that you spend your time trying to convert people who are convertible, right, and not sort of spend your time trying to deal with people who are never going to change, because life's short, right? You want to save your energies for people.
If somebody tells you that their father took the strap to them and they're glad,
right.
Those are the kinds of people that maybe not so much.
Yeah, that would be, a fairly good way of figuring out whether or not this was going to be somebody that you could actually, right, then they're never going to be able to have a voluntaristic approach to any kind of authority, for sure.
I think also, one thing I just wanted to point out real quickly about a market anarchy is that you really do allow for anyone to maximize their values. You know, so if you have someone that wants to sort of live on a commune and not use money, or they want to have an equal distribution of wealth, then they're perfectly free to go buy some land and occupy some land and distribute the wealth as they see fit. You know, they don't have to participate in the market with the rest of us.
Oh, that's quite right, and that's an excellent point. And this is something that I use with Canadians who are, you know, almost as collectivist. I mean, they make the board look like a bunch of individuals. But when Canadians say, well, it's a fundamental Canadian value, the sort of helping the poor and helping, it's like, great! If it's a fundamental Canadian value, why on earth would we need the overhead of the government?
Exactly.
I mean, if everybody wants to do it anyway, surely having the government involved is a huge waste of resources. It's just an additional layer that's not sort of required.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, so everybody wants to say it's voluntary, but then when you say let's make it voluntary, they're like, oh, well, no, it can't be voluntary because people won't do it. It's like, but then it's not a fundamental Canadian value. Like, you know what I mean?
Exactly. It's just kind of the lack of, this enters into the lack of justification for the existence of government.
Right.
People try to give this kind of argument saying, well, but it's our fundamental values, you know, we have to do this and that. Let's say, well, okay, that's great. So either everyone is moral like you are and agrees with you, in which case we have no problem, we don't need government, or no one agrees with you, or most people don't agree with you and don't want these things, in which case, what argument do you have to say that these are fundamental values and we have to do them?
Right, and I think
you don't really have a choice here. It's either one or the other. Either people agree with you or they don't.
I was just thinking, when you talk to people about helping the poor, they say they really want to, but they don't think that you can help the poor without a government. And this is interesting because I heard John Stossel talking about this, where Bono is telling a whole group of people at his concert to tell the government to give more foreign aid to Africa.
Yeah.
But by all means, don't tell the kids who have disposable income enough to go to his concert to give money and things to people in Africa.
Exactly.
It's amazing how generous these rich guys can be with other people's money. Yeah.
Well, they don't understand, like, it makes them think that you can't give money to poor people unless you have the government to do it for you.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like the people who say, well, what are we going to do about the roads if there's no government? They just don't even, it doesn't even occur to them that a person can fix a road.
Yeah, that's one of the things, it's so simple. You know, you take something like indoor plumbing, you know, or sewers, and people say, well, how could you have that without the government? And right. it, something like that is just so fundamental. It's like, well, who doesn't want to have indoor plumbing? I mean, come on now.
No, don't really
need this.
Well, if I had a balcony.
exactly.
That's yeah, like nobody ever says that about computers, right? Like computers are done by the free market. They're a little bit more complicated than plumbing, right? But it's like somehow we can figure out how to build a cray, but we can't figure out how to make a toilet flush without the steam.
Stefan, there are actually some people who do say that.
That that we need the government for that stuff too?
Exactly.
Yeah.
For sure, yeah, absolutely.
But
I can't imagine
really
what Windows... Sorry, go ahead.
Would rather give money to a king in Africa who wants to put, you know, lion carpeting on his floor rather than to, you know...
lion carpeting.
Well, you know what I mean, to have a leopard hat and, you know...
If only it were the lion hides that they were putting on their floors, it wouldn't be so bad.
Yeah.
their populations that they make their coats out of, right?
Exactly. So, yeah, the lack of justification for government, I think we kind of covered all this.
Good stuff.
And also, like I said before, we should also mention the burden of proof. And the basic issue here, like you said, Stefan, at the beginning, people believe that we have the burden of proof as anarchists because
it's so wacky.
Because it's so wacky. But, in fact, the burden of proof applies to any positive position, correct? Any statement about reality.
Yeah, for sure. Whoever's coming up with the theory is the one who has to make the case for that theory. And the first thing that is involved, and again, this is all the way back to Socrates, the first thing that's always involved is to getting people to understand that they don't know what they think they know. Right? Because the basic fact of where everyone comes up with their ideas is that they're conformist, as I sort of talked about in a recent podcast. They just sort of, they go along with whatever people say, and then they come up with reasons for it afterwards.
Right,
so people don't sort of start from first principles and say, you know, the thing we really need to do is to have a state and this and that. They don't start with first principles. What they do is they say, well, the state is good. What kind of nonsense can I come up with to justify that?
Exactly.
And if you end up taking the burden of proof on yourself, then you're assuming that other people have proven their ideas before, and they haven't. All they're doing is repeating propaganda, and so they're never going to be able to understand that unless you actually ask them for the reasons, right? And they'll hate you for it, for the most part, but it is important to point out that people don't know what they think they know. Because if they think they know, they're never going to learn anything, right?
That's exactly how Christians rationalize the yucky stuff in the Bible, I've found, you know. First of all, you know that God is love, and then you have to figure out how that translates to the great flood.
Right. God is love, and he really loved the fishes more than the people on dry land. So let's make a big home for them. No, I agree. And so the important thing is to understand when you are and are not arguing rationally with people. I think that's very, very important. Because if you think you're arguing rationally when you're really not, then you are going to waste a lot of time, I think, trying to get people to understand something
Absolutely.
That they're willing, that they're not even willing to even think about. So that's why the burden of proof's got to be put on other people.
You need to start by first principles. You need to start by the simplest. You need to start with moral argument and geometry, starting with three people. Moral argument starting with, for example, guns or whatever other form of government intervention people want,
right.
Such as taxation, stealing. Is it okay if I steal from you? Is it okay if I steal from you to give it to the other guy? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and you can just justify it by saying that, you know, theories need to deal with what is simpler before they can deal with what is more complicated, right? So before you get to the common good, you have to sort of deal with two guys in a room or three guys in a room, right? Because if a theory doesn't work when it's simple, it sure as heck isn't going to work when things get more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Robin Hood.
So the burden of proof, I think, is very similar to the Christian arguments, which is basically saying that God exists and it has all these attributes, etc. And then the first thing you ask, well, what is God? And I think here we have the same situation, and we ask, what is the state? And if we must come to, I think we must come to the conclusion that the state is a group of people, is an arbitrary group of people who enforce their, who so, are somehow have the right to enforce their value system on everyone else. And then you have to ask, how come these people have that right and no one else does?
Right. And then people always say, well, it's voluntary. And it's like, okay, well, if it's voluntary, then it's not the state. Like, I always think people who say, oh, George Bush is so smart or whatever, it's like, well, what you should do is subscribe to his newsletter. Right, so that, or call him and get that recorded message every morning that says, hey, George, you know, tell me what it is I should do with my day. Right, and if they think he's so smart, they could just make that individual, right? They can just
exactly.
do it themselves. There's no
exactly.
need to get everybody else involved, right? It's like Scientology, then. If you think L. Ron Hubbard is this great guy, then great, you don't, you know, go call him up and say, how should I spend my day? But don't worry about having it in a state. That doesn't make any sense at all, because other people might not have that opinion.
Exactly. It's just an opinion or a personal need or a personal product.
Right, right.
It's not an ultimate... it's like I would buy a Ford or a Kia, or I don't think everyone should buy them.
Right.
Well, that's the thing, that's the issue.
Because we all have different value systems, and it always comes back to value systems.
That's the issue, though, because when you talk about it, people always think that their personal lives are just not, you know, they're not important. They don't have anything to do with these big, lofty things that we're talking about. They think, you know, you're talking about these problems, it's all about, like, you know, what do you do when you're in a sinking rowboat with two other people? Who do you save rather than you know, buying a house?
But that has nothing to do with morality. Though this whole idea that morality is about, you know, someone's about to die, but if you save him, five other people will die.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's funny because I read this parody page once of philosophy, and it was a guy setting up a parody of a moral dilemma, saying, there's five people laying down on this track, but one of them is going to be the father of a murderer, and the other one is going to become a doctor, is going to save one of the victims of this son. And then on the on the other track,
oh no,
there's a pregnant woman, and she, you know what, she set up this giant, and now you have to decide in which direction you're going to pull the lever.
Right. Yeah. I think
really,
that stuff
it's
very
hilarious.
Funny.
And you don't ask why those darn people are so stupid for lying down the track in the first.
Yeah, but it's not. It's a parody. But
yeah.
I just thought this is what people think morality is. It's
people
ridiculous.
Think morality is what other people should do or not do, rather than what they do every day.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, it's as part of the challenge that we still have, I think, as a group, is like trying to figure out, again, how to sort of get more women involved. And it's sort of in my experience that women are not particularly trained to think in abstractions. And I'm not sure I know exactly why. I don't think it's because they can't, because, I mean, Christine is fantastic at this. But I think that finding a way to personalize philosophy can be helpful for people like that. And it's not just women, of course. But
that's
it's
a great... thing, because I've been meaning to talk about this just a little bit in talking about moral realism, and we've been writing about this a lot. I have received nothing but support from women, and that's not saying that there's a lot of support, because there's not a lot of women talking to me, and a lot of rejection and confusion from men, and it's mostly atheists who read things that I write and what Frank writes. But I kind of started thinking about how perhaps, and maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, that women might have an easier time accepting moral realism, because moral decisions, I mean, maybe so many women my age and a little bit younger have dealt with issues that are big and personal at the same time when talking about things like reproduction. You know, so many of us have come face first into the decision, should I keep this baby, or, you know,
right.
am I going to have a baby because now I'm 30 years old? And all these kinds of things confront women because we have to confront them at young ages.
Right, that's
you know,
very
we just
interesting.
Have to.
Yeah.
And maybe because of that, women are like, well, of course morality is based on facts, because I can't make these decisions based on, like, you know, a bunch of intellectuals getting together, you know, chewing the fat. This is something I have to do.
Right.
And I don't know if I'm right about this, but it seems like maybe it's easier for women to accept that than some young guys I've been talking to.
Right. No, I think that's very interesting. And, of course, the other reason why it's so important is women are the, you know, if you look at the fact that most women do are the ones who are the primary caregivers for the for children sort of up front, that women are sort of the primary moral instructors, and they have to sort of deal with moral questions when, you know, children are barely able to keep their poo inside their own bodies, right? So they can't really go to heavy abstractions when it comes to teaching your toddler not to grab other kids' toys and so on. You don't start with, well, you know, this toy wasn't exactly in a state of nature and so on. I think it's a little bit more tangible about how women who end up being the primary caregivers have to teach ethics to children. It's a little bit more tangible, and I think that's
very
why...
Very tangible and very practical.
They should think about abstraction stuff.
I agree they should, but I'm not saying that that's particularly where it's going to help them in the immediate sort of sense.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you really want to teach... The only way to teach morality, in my opinion, is to show how something is in someone's self-interest. To show the person how it's in his self-interest and show it concretely.
Right.
So,
no,
but
I agree.
You can't do that. You can't do that if you can't reason in abstractions. I don't think.
I think that's why I think when whoever the primary caregivers are in this situation, and I saw this a lot, of course, when I worked in a daycare, the problem with that kind of stuff then tends to be that you end up with a situation where the primary caregivers are basically only interested in getting conformity rather than in getting sort of people to understand.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right,
of course
and that's.
They are.
And that's a real shame.
Don't have to think in abstractions. They don't have to explain anything to their children. They just have to say, you're going to do this or I'm going to whoop your ass a chair.
I think you can see this kind of application of like moral realism on television. I don't know if you've ever watched that Super Nanny show.
Oh, yeah,
for
sure.
I really see some of this in action. She's constantly, I mean... she's not just corralling children into conformity, but she's taking, you know, families that are so insistent on having this religious model of a household to the detriment of their family that it's falling apart, and she's using practical and factual matters in teaching ethics to kids.
It's like triage, right? I mean, she's just trying to get the family from killing each other. And the best way to do that is like just sort of give very practical things, like give tangible rewards to your children for doing the right thing rather than teach them about abstract ethics. But that's sort of like complaining that a surgeon on a battlefield isn't checking someone's appendix, right? They just kind of keep the leg from falling off, right?
Right, exactly. And talking about explaining market anarchy to people, I would like Andrew to talk about this because he's done a lot of work with young teenagers in that aspect.
Well, I don't know, I can just touch briefly. I mean, I'm still currently, I'm just going to my last week as a substitute teacher just trying to make some extra cash because, again, the state does make it quite lucrative. You know, it's $90 a day in my district to be a substitute teacher. So for 7 hours of doing pretty much nothing, you get $90, which is decent. So I might as well go there and try and...
Well, aren't you either they get taught by you or by someone who doesn't know what they're talking about.
Exactly. So I was just telling Frank that just on Thursday, actually, I was in the school and I was talking to some kids and...
You were working detention?
Yeah, I was working, first of all, in this room that's called the box, which is...
Yeah, great job.
Yeah, which is a room with no windows on the interior of the school, and it's for the kids who have been bad, and they're sent there to serve their in-school suspension. And basically just sit there and be quiet. That's the whole purpose. So anyways, I was in there for an hour and was talking with these kids. And in my experience, you know, a lot of these kids, you know, first of all, who are in the box are, you know, the disenfranchised ones. You know, you have sort of two types of kids in school. You have the ones that are just go along with everything and never question anything, never, you know, really say anything outside of what the teacher wants them to. And then you have those who act out. And the ones who are acting out are sort of the ones in the box, and they I think really are really prone to sort of understanding these types of arguments. You know, they are able to understand a lot better, I guess, than the so-called good kids. So anyways, we were just talking. I've done this with you know, a bunch of kids now that just sort of present some simple things. You know, just sort of point out that, hey, you know, the school is owned by the government, you know. So do you think that you're going to get, you know, what type of message about the government do you think you're going to get from the school and from the teachers? And, you know, all these things, you know, and I can go into, I guess, some more examples, but I guess the show's close to being over. So, you know, you can go, you know, all different examples, but the kids, I think, generally are pretty adept at understanding these types of things. And it really is simple, you know. We've spent some time on the Internet just talking with people and just, you know, sort of presenting the argument, you know. You know, one, only individuals exist, you know, and what's good for one is good for all, and what's bad for one is bad for all, and, you know, just sort of explaining the model about, you know, how you want to have, you know, trade instead of force and all these things. And people generally, I think, are very receptive to the arguments.
Yeah, because that's how they live their own lives, right? So.
Exactly.
Well, the main thing is that we mostly talk to atheists. And if you're an atheist, in most cases, not in my case, but in most cases, you have already had to do a big leap, intellectual leap, in becoming an atheist.
Yeah, and also I think just, you know, sort of the idea that these things, you know, that we're told are moral. You know, we're told since a very young age, of course, that, you know, God is moral, and if you don't believe in God, that, you know, you're an immoral person. Well, once you sort of make that leap and understand that, hey, you know, this concept isn't even real, you know, that I'm told that it's so good, now I understand it's not even real, then you can, you know, the leap to sort of understand that, hey, you know, the government isn't real either, you know, it's just a gang of, you know, the most organized crime in the world, that it's a lot easier to make that leap once you've sort of made the leap from, you know, religion to atheism.
I think that's quite true.
Absolutely. So I don't know if you guys have any further points of discussion here.
Well, I would just like to point out that, you know, a lot of this stuff, it's hard to know where exactly to approach it from because, you know, it sort of starts as like a political thing, but what it ends up for me and I guess for everybody, you know, eventually is it becomes, you know, well, how do I implement these ideas in my personal life? And this is something that actually, you know, Steph has helped me with and, you know, through his podcast and such. But absolutely, it becomes a very personal thing about, you know, how you're going to implement these ideas in your life. And this is,
exactly,
you know, sort of talking about these things on a, you know, abstract political level about, you know, well, how will we organize society? You know, what do we do about nuclear weapons and blah, blah, blah. All those things are very nice to think about and really interesting and of course, very important issues. But perhaps more important is what do you do with them now in your life and sort of what comes out of it for you. And, you know, as I said, the rabbit hole, you know, it goes really deep, and it's really interesting to see where it sort of leads you. You know, once you sort of start this line of thinking, where does it go, you know? And that's
interesting.
Yeah.
And this is another argument that is sometimes used is, well, anarchy is silly because it'll never happen, and it's completely sterile, which I don't agree at all. I think it's... intellectually, I think it's extremely fertile, and morally also.
Sure, and it's absolutely vibrant, and I love the vibes I get, you know, just from being on certain message boards and talking on Skype with people and whatever, you know, just talking about those ideas. It feels absolutely exciting, and it feels like, you know, we're on the cusp of something, you know, like this, people are actually producing these ideas now, and we're building on them and figuring out how these things can work, and it's a very... exciting process, and I'm absolutely excited. You know, I'm 20 now, so I have hopefully, you know, quite a few decades left in me. But you know, I'm absolutely excited to see how these things will develop in my own lifetime because, you know, it's something that it's not quite so abstract. You know, these things actually do you know, develop, and these ideas become part of you know, the society, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that thanks to Stefan and his commitment to morality, I think we have a great way to reach people now, and I think that we're having a lot of success, and I don't think it's futile. I think it really works, and I think that if we can get enough people to understand these concepts, I mean, I think we could have a very different kind of society.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, I agree. And it doesn't matter, really, whether people end up being anarchists or not, because I don't want to put my own happiness in the sort of being completely dependent on other people's capacity to be rational. That wouldn't
be
rational
exactly.
In and of itself, right?
Exactly. And the other part is, it also applies to one's own life. I mean, it's not really something that only applies to politics. It's a moral issue.
Yeah, primarily, I think it's a moral issue. The politics are secondary, in my view.
Well, yeah, because the whole area of politics is an extension of your values. I mean, if you believe in force, then obviously you won't see any value in a free society.
Right.
I mean, it comes back to the parenting thing. I mean, if you've been raised to believe in these moral premises of coercion, then you're not going to see anything wrong with the state.
Right.
I was just thinking, yes, and we know that we can all live long, healthy, rewarding lives, even while living under the government of Canada.
Yeah.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, of course, it's a lot better now than it was in the Middle Ages, right? It's important also
Absolutely.
To recognize that we're doing a lot better now. We have a lot more opportunity now, like conversations like this, than we ever did before. So there's a lot to be thankful for from that standpoint.
Definitely. All states are absolute evils, and all states are parasites on good people. But the rise in science and technology has permitted us to make it more livable while we're being oppressed. You know.
Yeah.
And here we
have
the internet.
Exactly.
Where it's not a country anymore. You can't just say, well, here in America, you know. You're talking on the internet now, and we're talking to people from all over the world.
The internet is probably the single most powerful, that and science. Those are really the biggest examples of what the market anarchist process can do.
Yeah.
The internet and things in the internet like Wikipedia, which is another great example of this kind of thing, what this kind of cooperation can do. I mean, that's what it's all about. So we don't have much time left, so if you guys don't have any more points, we can...
No, I'm good. Thank you so much. It was great fun. I really enjoyed it.
Yes, and why don't you give our coordinates?
Mm-hmm. You can come and hear our other broadcasts on hellboundalley.com, and you can send us all a message at ally@hellboundalley.com. That's ALLEE.
On our live show tomorrow, we will have Reverend Jeremiah, who has a lot of sermons on, I don't remember his website.
ReverendJeremiah.com.
And so that's going to be great. And next week we have Refuting Theism with Science with Edward Grieve. We're going to talk about the irony of religiously inclined scientists. And we're going to get started. I don't know if we're going to finish them. We're going to talk about the atheological arguments that use science.
Edward Grieve, any relation to Andrew?
Yes,
that's my brother.
Ah, very nice. Full disclosure, always important.
Exactly. So goodbye, everyone.
Thanks very much.
Ciao.
Take care.